Few Good Men with Murray Jones. Sponsored by Help Enterprises, a social enterprise helping people with disabilities lead fulfilling and independent lives.
Hi, I'm Murray Jones. This is A Few Good Men, the podcast that brings together men who are raising children with disabilities and offers them a safe place to share their stories, struggles and triumphs.
This is where men should really talk more to each other.
And our world changed forever that day. And it's never been the same since.
My journey as a father to a child with a disability has been challenging. But it has also given me strength and resilience that I never knew I had. I realised how important it is to have a support system and how lonely it is without one.
I was some burnout. Everyone has a plan for the future, but whether it goes that way is another thing.
Told you I wasn't going to cry today, mate. Everyone has the ability to have a ripple effect in whatever way they choose to.
This podcast aims to understand some of the very difficult and unexpected journeys that many men have experienced when raising children with a disability and the way that has altered the course of their lives.
I've done the job, the loving husband and the father and all that sort of stuff, but what about me? How do I relearn who I am?
The immense challenges, the lonely roads, and of course, the rewards that can be discovered along the way.
Make the most of what you've got. They are your kids. Look after them. Do the best you can.
I don't think Iris have ever bothered with the negatives of anything. If we're having a bad day, well, tomorrow's another day.
My hope is this podcast finds its voice in the world and enables men in similar situations to share their stories and help each other navigate the unknown roads ahead.
A Few Good Men with Murray Jones. Sharing stories of the unexpected journeys men have experienced when raising children with disabilities that need lifelong support. A Few Good Men.
We often hear about stories that grip the nation, stories of resilience, survival and hope. But what happens when those stories leave the headlines? When the cameras are gone and you're left facing the reality and challenges of everyday life? Nathan Ezard experienced this firsthand. While many people were captivated by the story of his son William going missing in the Victorian bush, it's his ongoing commitment to nurturing his diverse family that really deserves a spotlight. With six children, each with their unique journeys and challenges, Nathan stands as a beacon of what it means to persevere, love and nurture, even when the world isn't watching. In this episode, Nathan shares with us the challenges of parenting in the shadows of a media spotlight and the depth of dedication required in the quiet moments that truly define our lives. Nathan, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on A Few Good Men.
Thanks very much for agreeing to come on.
Pleasure.
And have a chat. Tell us a little bit about your family.
So I've got six children, four bio kids and two step kids. They're all boys. The youngest two are 15, and then they go up at 17, 19, 21, and 23 for the eldest.
Six altogether.
Six boys. They're all very close.
Close as in proximity or close friends?
Friends.
Look after each other, do they?
They look after each other. They see each other at least weekly, often a couple of nights a week, and take care of each other very nicely.
And have they all got a reasonable level of independence or not?
Sort of. So my 21-year-old has a thing called POTS, pulmonary orthostatic tachycardia, and that leaves him with a very low level of energy. Also has attention deficit disorder. Well, they pretty much all have attention deficit disorder, which they get from me. And then his brother, who he lives with, has a thing called Perthes disease.
That's what I haven't heard of.
Yeah, it's the top of the femur dies and the growth head disintegrates and then hopefully regrows. In Gabriel's case, it died when he was only two, so very young, and then didn't successfully start regrowing until he was six. And he has a lot of trouble walking and a lot of pain all the time.
Jeepers.
All very, very highly intelligent, but each have their own struggles.
Okay, so they're all verbal.
So my four bio kids are all verbal, yes. In fact, I would argue that they're all very verbal.
Okay.
And then there's my stepkids. They're not so independent.
Yeah.
So Will is 17 and he's nonverbal and is considered to have an intellectual disability. Essentially, when they do tests to assess intellectual disability or not, he simply doesn't respond to their tests. So they have to give him, the minimum IQ level due to unresponsive.
So he's never said a word?
No, when he was younger, he had, at his peak, he maybe had a couple of dozen words. And then as he's gotten older, his words have reduced to virtually none. He will occasionally same mum, and he has various utterances. So he has one in particular where he does a sort of a guttural, oh, which generally indicates, yeah, I don't want that. And other than that, mum, he has no communications with his voice. Now, sometimes he will sort of sing and make echolalia-style sounds, but no verbal communication as such, but has excellent receptive language. So he understands most of what you say to him most of the time.
Do you use any visual sort of communication aids at all?
We have. We've used PECs at one point or for quite a long time. We don't so much anymore. Will isn't keen on that sort of, well, he's not keen on communication. He essentially uses a couple of visual cues. He taps his chest, and that's usually, it has a massive range of meaning from yes to I want to me, goodbye, just a general positive communication.
Yeah, a few of the blokes that I've spoken to, you know, where they're primarily sons, they're non-verbal, and, you know, they've sort of established their own language. Have you done that with William?
Yeah, very much so. Communication is very subtle, and it's around looks and gestures and eye movements. And he does, I suppose, rely on Penny and myself a lot to just know what he needs and be able to read his mood and read those subtle areas of nonverbal communication and just be there and around him and know what's going on. And we keep him to a fairly strict routine, which helps.
Okay.
You can tell very quickly when he's getting agitated, and then you sort of look for the things that will help calm him. And he's very good at self-regulation. So he uses primarily an iPad, which he puts up to his ear like a 80s ghetto blaster and listens to anything from Thomas the Tank Engine to other kids' songs and a few pop songs, some Katy Perry and things like that. And that just, he adjusts his mood with music, essentially.
Our boy Fred, who's got autism and he's not completely nonverbal. I mean, he can talk and read, but he chooses not to communicate very well. But, yeah, that music, listening to music, he's always got his iPad on at full blast. And, fortunately, we're getting a bit more of a repertoire than just the Wiggles lately, which is good. The world's oldest Wiggles fan, you know. I reckon I know every song by heart, mate. I could probably quote the Yellow Wiggle.
Oh, believe me, so could I.
And tell me about Robin.
So Robin is 15 and he makes up for Will's non-verbal by being extremely verbal.
What's his diagnosis? He's autism?
Autism.
Yeah.
And he has excellent, above his age for vocabulary, listens to masses of audiobooks and reads, and as a result has an excellent vocabulary. Probably not quite as good receptive language, interestingly. And he struggles with a lot of anxiety, probably one of the biggest things that he has to struggle with.
Does he go to school? Or?
Both boys attend Mansfield Autism Statewide Services in Mansfield in Victorian High Country. It shortens to MASS, and they're an organisation that have been around about 60 years.
Really?
And they were started by a couple who were both doctors here in Mansfield who had a son with autism. And it started as sort of a holiday program and then has gradually progressed into being what's essentially an outreach program. So they go into the community and they send out what they call MAPS, Mansfield Autism Practitioners, into the home to help families raise their children with autism.
Did you move to Mansfield because of that school, or was it just coincidence?
We were very tempted to, but we were told, no, there's not room, because Will first came up here almost 10 years ago for his first placement. So we've been coming up here for a long time, and it wasn't until after Will was lost on Mount Disappointment for 3 days and the fallout that happened after that we were invited up here on a full-time basis.
Tell me a bit about that. I know the way we've connected is I've sort of reached out to you because of that incident that happened a couple of years ago, sort of stuck in my mind. And
So Will was walking with his brother Robin, his father and his father's partner on Mount Disappointment doing bushwalk, and Will got separated from them and they run over to find him.
What, did he run off or something?
He ran off.
Yeah.
He ran ahead on the path and then they ran ahead to find him and they couldn't find him. They backtracked and they couldn't find him. They ran forward. And it turns out he'd left the path. So the police were called in and the rescue services, and we were called. We were living down at Clifton Springs on the Bellarine Peninsula, south of Geelong at the time. And we got a phone call to say he's disappeared. He's missing in bushland. And you need to come to the centre of operations up there at Mount Disappointment and be on standby while the rescue unfolds.
Well, as it turned out, you were the sort of, you seemed to have the spotlight on you the whole time.
We did very much. I was actually in the local supermarket when I got the phone call from Penny to say he's missing. And I've sort of halfway through putting my groceries through and I've just said to the lady, I'm sorry, I have to go straight away. I just found out my son has gone missing in bushland. And she said, leave it, go, we'll sort it out for you. And so I ran home, we jumped in the car and we went up there. And of course, we kept a fairly low profile for the first couple of days of Will's disappearance. But then after, I suppose they wanted to raise the profile and get more volunteers and get people in the public looking for him and helping around the edges of the national park and state forest. They got us to get in front of cameras, particularly Penny, to make an appeal, a public appeal.
The media were all over it. I remember that. Like, it was not just in Australia, but internationally they started to pick it up as well. It was a big story.
They did. I have relatives in England and friends in America, and it made it as far as England and America. And that was quite amazing to realise. And yes, up on the mountain, and then afterwards the media were very keen to interview us and, get us.
It's interesting what you said, because you were in the spotlight, and up until you told me that it was actually his biological dad who was taking him for a bushwalk, that wasn't sort of evident in the media coverage. It was kind of like, and to be honest, in some ways, it's almost like it looked like, you know, you were kind of under the spotlight and, you know, potentially under suspicion for being negligent. Or did you feel that or not?
Look, the police certainly gave everyone significant interviews and explored those angles to some degree. And I'm aware that there were some things said, particularly within the online community, along those lines. But I largely just kept my head down and avoided any of that side of things. So I'm probably somewhat in that way because, I really did not want to. I avoided them.
Your focus was obviously on finding William, and thankfully there was a great outcome.
Well, it wasn't just on that. It was on the recovery afterwards, which was a big thing, because you get that sort of level of media coverage and then for a few weeks afterwards you've just got different media outlets contacting you all day, every day. And doing interviews, and people are offering to help with this and help with that. And we did get some amazing help. And then that sort of fades off a bit. And then you go back to your regular suburban anonymity.
Was that a weird thing to be in the spotlight for, you know, for all the wrong reasons, have your 15 minutes of fame? And
It left a big void. And where you sort of, everyone was so ecstatic about William being found.
Yeah.
And then you sort of, you go back to your everyday struggles and they're the hard bit. And then suddenly no one's interested. And I suppose that was hard. It's like everyone's interested in the sensationalist story, but no one's really interested in the day-to-day struggle of what it is to have a disability and what it is to care for someone with a disability.
Was there anything after that sort of media circus that if you had been able to change the outcome or anything that, you know, you wish had happened after that when you were in the spotlight?
It's an interesting question, because that sort of wish things could have changed, I suppose that's something you think about a bit as a parent.
Yeah.
As you get older, perhaps, you know, what if I'd done something differently? And Robin will often give me what ifs. And as I say to Robin, I don't do what ifs.
You don't do what ifs, no.
Because there is no what if. And I wouldn't know what I know, and I wouldn't be who I am if anything had happened differently, potentially.
Yeah.
So I think we are who we are. We are what we are. There's, from our perspective at least, time is concrete. You can't change the past. We talk about facing the future, walking forward into the future, because I don't know why really, but where I grew up, they talk about walking backwards into the future.
Walking backwards into the future.
Walking backwards into the future, because you can see the past. So that's where you're looking. Whereas you don't know what's going to happen in the future, so you can't see it. So you're walking backwards into the future.
But
if you look carefully at what's going on in the past, you can have a pretty good idea of what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting philosophy. You know, one of the primary reasons for this podcast is exactly that. It is a journey. You know, I mean, I've experienced it firsthand. I don't have six kids. I've got three, and our oldest is Fred. But, you know, I related to your story because a few years ago now, about 4 years ago, I took Fred for a walk around an old disused dam. And long story short, he ran. you know, down the path plenty of times. You didn't sort of just circumnavigate. You could, you know, right around the perimeter of the dam, it sort of meandered off and in around the bush and everything. And he bolted, and I ran after him. And because it was winter, it hadn't been used as much and it was overgrown. And then when I caught up to him, I turned back and couldn't find a way back. And, you know, there was a search and rescue, and it was like, fortunately, we were found that night. But as it got cold, and it's all very well for the sun to shine here in winter, but at 4 or 5 o'clock, it's freezing again. And we just had shorts and, you know, light clothes on and stuff. And it was really scary. It was really scary. And I understand that sort of suddenly people are rushing in, oh, you're okay. And gee, wow, that what an ordeal. And it was. And, you know, it's, I mean, funnily enough, Fred and I haven't been on a bushwalk since. He just doesn't want to go. But there was a beautiful moment there when he, you know, I was the one scared. And he was, you know, he stayed calm and he just came up and he just must have sensed it and gave me a big hug and sort of, oh, don't worry, Dad, you know, without saying a word. So it's just a moment that'll stick in my mind forever. But you're absolutely right, Nathan. It's that, it's all very well for, and it's great, you know, people care and they go, oh, wow, that's great. And he's found and, you know, anything we do to help. But then life kicks in and people go back to doing, you know, their life. And that's the day-to-day struggle, isn't it? How do you communicate? How do you, all the day-to-day things that I'm sure you do for William, you've got to make sure you look after him, you know, the bathroom, make sure he showers, make sure he does this, make sure he's got food, you know, all that sort of, there's so many different things on a daily basis.
It's a full-time job, really. He requires assistance with every task. So that is a big thing. And look, his mum does the vast majority of that. But, you know, he's now getting close to 6 foot. And so his mum's not anything like 6 foot. So when it comes to things like showering and washing hair, that's where I have to step in. Penny simply couldn't do it because he's just too tall for it to reach. And being large, there are other times and other things that where you need someone of equal or greater height to really be able to take on that.
I'm assuming, does he go to the kitchen and help himself to a meal or not?
No, not at all. He will go to the fridge and indicate that he's hungry and then tell us what he wants, but then we have to, of course, prepare that.
You know, the other sort of thing from there is what happens. One of the questions I think on everyone's mind is what happens when inevitably no one's around forever. Do you think about that much? What's in store?
That's something that I think, as you say, we all have to think about that. And I think whether you've got children with disabilities or not, that's something as a parent you consider. What happens when I'm not here to fill in and help? And of course, when you've got children with disabilities, that just becomes a far greater concern.
Well, it certainly does. Can I ask Nathan, like, you know, you sound like a pretty glass half full bloke, but how have you gone? Like, it's been a long journey. Your eldest is, what, 23?
I really struggled after William's disappearance, and I got funding to go and see a psychologist, and that was a very, very important stage for me, really looking that stuff out. But it was exhausting more than anything.
Good on you for doing that, first of all.
Well, yeah, it's important, I think, to talk about these things.
Yeah, absolutely.
And just voicing stuff sometimes is enough. And then when you've got a professional in a position to then sort of lend a bit of advice as well and sort of direct your thinking, direct the way you're processing what's happened, it is extremely helpful. But it's still that sort of trauma leaves an indelible mark, sometimes I think referred to as scar tissue. And those incidents don't go away. And that scar tissue sort of becomes part of who you are. And that's not to say that's a bad thing. It just becomes part of who you are. I think with trauma, you don't necessarily ever fully recover as such, but you go through the different stages, I guess, of grief. And you go through the sort of, you know, the shock and denial, guilt, and one of those big ones is depression. And for myself, that's something I've struggled with anyway in my life. And so that sort of
since you had children or generally?
No, just generally, something I've struggled with since my childhood.
Well, I'm not a psychologist, so we won't go too deep into that, but I think people who, you know, perceive to have a perfect life, and you pull back the layers, I mean, we've all got something going on. We've all got crosses to bear, I think.
Absolutely.
You know.
I like to, as you say, go the glass half full with it. And they say that the more intelligent you are, the more you struggle with depression. So I just think I'm really smart.
Do you think that the incident with William, was that on its own the catalyst for having to seek assistance with your mental health, or You think you've been bottling a lot of stuff up and go, and that was it? It was kind of like the genie's out of the bottle?
I think that not quite. I think that had I not, or so I went down the path of seeing, getting professional help for mental health related issues in my early 20s.
Right.
And I think that that left me in a position where when it came round to the aftermath of Will's disappearance, that I was already in a position where I knew what to do. I could see the symptoms popping up. I could feel the cracks emerging. And so I was very much, yeah, I need to get and see someone and I need to do it soon because I'm going to fall apart if I don't. So, yeah, it meant that as I started to see, I'd get unusually emotional about silly little things. Watch it, you know, advert on TV or something on those lines where it's a little bit cute or special and you burst into tears and sort of where things, you have disproportionately emotional responses to things. Was one of the things that I suppose I picked up on, not being able to watch any TV or movies or anything that had any form of violence in it because it would just be too much. Not being able to get anywhere near the news because, again, just finding it just too overwhelming and just finding that my emotions were brittle.
Well, that answers my question. I was going to say, what were the signs? And, you know, for the blokes listening out there, I'd give them a clue themselves, yeah, to, you know, if they need to reach out. So you'd become sort of oversensitive, do you think, to anything
perhaps
else?
Yeah, oversensitive is possibly a good way to describe it, yeah.
Yeah.
And not as robust as I'd normally be. It's not just, I suppose, emotionally robust, but also physically. I started to get a bit more sick more easily. More tired, more regularly, not necessarily coping with the more conflict-oriented aspects of parenting.
Yeah.
Wanting to just pull back and not have to push those harder parts of parenting where you have to sort of, you know, draw a line in the sand sort of stuff. And I suppose having been through a few... In a lot of ways, it's really the grief process. It's the same as when, for instance, I first had to go through the diagnosis with Perthes with my son Gabriel. And when Gabby was 4, so about halfway through that initial period, we were on a family walk.
Yeah.
And he wasn't allowed to run or jump because of the extra pressure that would put on the top of the femur and the hip, and that would then cause any new growth to get crushed and therefore not form in a nice shape. And he got to a point where he was so frustrated by that restriction that he just started slamming his bad leg, his right leg, into the ground as hard as he could, causing pain to himself, to the point where I had to let go of his hand and then say, right, you're 4, but now you're going to have to be the one responsible for deciding when you walk, when you run, when you jump, and the pain that's involved, because that's what you're telling me. You're not happy with me controlling that. And then that sort of having to take a step back at that for him at that age and watch him go through the pain and not be able to cushion it was probably the first time I really experienced sort of that parental grief.
Mm, that helplessness.
Mm. That helplessness and the emotions that came up with that were very hard to deal with. And, of course, you got the guilt that you feel over that, not being able to be a better parent, not being able to protect him.
Well, and part of the problem too is I think that in amongst all that, you've got to somehow hold it all together because, you know, they still need, you know.
Well, that's it. There's no stopping.
So you're never really off, are you?
No, that's right.
There's no relenting.
No.
Tell me a bit more about that parental grief then. What you felt like you could be doing more.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's that, okay, what can I do to you first of all, you try and figure out how you're going to fix this. And so you want to get on top of it. You want to make a plan. You want to get on top of it and you want to, okay, what can I do? What can the medical department do? How can I change my responses? How can I convince him to just walk and take that on his own? And then you can't do that. There's no wrapping him in bubble wrap and avoiding all of it. And so then you feel bad, or I felt bad for not being able to fix it, not being able to find the solution to it.
And then
I get angry with myself. And that, of course, and you get depressed about the fact that you're not doing a better job and that you can't make their life perfect.
Mm.
And that it's somewhere in that, I guess you have to learn to accept.
I think it's a pretty common thing for blokes to, you want to fix it. I know when Fred got diagnosis at 2.5 or 3, we went down a million different roads to try and fix it. You know, how do we fix it? How do you fix it? And then when you realise that there's no fix, and it's obviously it's different for everyone, but it's that that acceptance of, okay, well, he is who he is. And you've had to do that 6 times.
Yeah.
So it's incredible, really. You know, I just can't imagine what that would be like.
Well, ultimately, I think it's been a beautiful experience, because ultimately what I've discovered is that when I stop trying to fix it and when I accept the circumstances, when I do that, I then stop trying to find stuff to make it different and learn to love what's there. And then you learn to love, to accept and see the beauty in it. And then ultimately my experience has been that I wouldn't change things. I wouldn't do things differently, because they are who they are. I am who I am. And there is beauty, tremendous beauty in that. And we're all different. We all have our challenges. And I wouldn't like to say it. It's hard to just, sorry.
No, mate, no, don't be sorry. That what you just said, mate, is amazing, really. You've kind of got to this point of not, beating yourself up and what can I do and how can I fix it and, how do I change, these people and make them better, or what you're, to get to that level of acceptance and then to go, actually, I see the beauty in it. I mean, that's an amazing message. I was just going to say, what sort of message would you give to the other dads out there who are on, different points in the journey? And I don't even have to ask, because that's just beautiful, mate, what you said. It's it really is.
Ultimately, I think I'm the luckiest man alive.
Wow.
And that I have been fortunate enough to be surrounded by some of the strongest, most beautiful, funny and resilient individuals that anyone could ever be surrounded by. Will may be non-verbal, but he has one of the best sense of humours I have ever come across. He cracks me up, absolutely has me in hysterics, and regularly laughs at me as well. Which I also think is fantastic. He's got such a positive outlook on life, and Gab's likewise. Of all my kids, Will and Gab have the most, they're the two of the probably the biggest challenges, and they have the most beautiful outlook on life, but they just keep going. And my William is the same. He's got the POTS and ADHD and other stuff going on there, but he just finds a beauty in those around him and in his own existence, and pays that forward and ends up looking after the people around him in his own way, and they look after each other. And I think that's ultimately what more could any parent want than to see their children making the world a more beautiful place. I mean, Will, everywhere he goes, people are left smiling.
Mm.
And everyone who's ever worked with him has just come away going, he's amazing.
Yeah, little bloke, for all the struggles and everything, I mean, the joy, it's just what you've just said there is it's fantastic, Nathan. I think in all honesty, they do, these very special people give us all a lesson in humanity.
Yeah, and funny you mentioned that word special, and I've heard it many times used in a sort of a derisive way.
Yeah,
it's meant to be insulting. Well, oh yes, he's very special, or you're special, or whatever else. But I think that the most special people I know, and special in what they can give, or what Will gives to me, or what Gab or any of my children give to me, it makes them so special and makes me feel special. And I just think that notion of it being a negative thing, and where people use it, I find very,
they've got special needs, it's like,
And it makes me angry, because you're missing the point that if you open your eyes and you open your heart and actually get to know anyone who has special needs, you'll realize that the special is there as a really beautiful and touching title.
Yeah, as opposed to a sort of a label, a derogatory, almost derogatory label of special needs, you know, so we'll put them over there in the box. And, you know, I sometimes use the term instead of disability, use the term special abilities, you know.
Absolutely.
Because they do. They can teach us a lot. And if you know, if people generally, I mean, it's, you know, obviously you're a very special bloke, Nathan. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, if people in the community generally, if there was more acceptance instead of labelling and saying, well, they're over there and we're over here and, you know, and there's this big divide, if we could all learn to sort of, you know, reach out and understand them all, the world would be a better place for sure.
It would. And ultimately, I think that's what I get out of, the thing I get most out of being caring for people with disability, being a carer, being a dad, is that someone like Will accepts perfectly the way things are, doesn't try and change anything.
Yeah.
He is who he is. Life is what it is. And he's just going to make the best of it. And that's probably the best message I think I could ever get in life, is that just being and being happy being.
Have you got a network of good people around you, good men or people, you know? Men and women.
I do have a couple of good close friends who there's another dad up here who's got a son at the Ort Centre who we get together every couple of weeks and chat and pretend to be lumberjacks and go out and collect firewood.
Oh, do you? And, oh, that's great. I'm a bit envious, mate. That high country in Mansfield's beautiful, isn't it?
It is.
Thanks, Nathan. Thank you very much for your time today.
You're
and
welcome.
It's been a great chat, mate, and you honestly, it's inspirational.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's nice to be able to share some of the struggles and some of the positives, and think that maybe some of my own struggles could make someone else's struggles a little more straightforward.
A problem shared is a problem halved, you know?
Yeah, very much.
I'm glad I reached out, mate, because you're a very good man. There's no doubt about that.
I don't know about that, but I've certainly tried to be the best man I can be, given who I am.
Well, you sound like you're doing a pretty good job, mate. That's for sure.
Oh, thank you.
If you enjoyed hearing Nathan's story, please share this episode. Don't forget to subscribe, and we'd really appreciate your reviews to help us keep these conversations going. Thanks again to our sponsor for their support of this podcast. Help Enterprises are a social enterprise helping people with disabilities lead fulfilling and independent lives. Next time on A Few Good Men, David Woods shares the heart-wrenching battle of fighting for his son Geordie, reminding us of the deep-rooted love and protective instincts of a father.
So I just sorted it out as a dad sorts something out, and I just pitched up at the front door and just told him how it was going to be, and if he didn't like it, what I was going to do. Well, one way to fix it, but it's not an answer, you know, like, it shouldn't happen. But it does.
I'm Murray Jones. Thanks for joining us on A Few Good Men. To keep the conversation going, please connect with us on our website. You'll find resources, stories from fellow fathers and caregivers, and ways to interact with our growing community. Visit afewgoodmen.com.au.
A Few Good Men, sponsored by Help Enterprises, a social enterprise helping people with disabilities lead fulfilling and independent lives. A Few Good Men is a Welcome Change Media production.